third class of four on the Vijnana Bhairava Tantra, and we'll finish up tomorrow afternoon. And then tomorrow night we'll have the little satsang with the whole ashram, and then on Sunday before we leave at 1 o'clock, I believe, we'll have a chance to have our own little satsang on questions and answers. So if your questions are arising, please write them down, and if you feel like the question hasn't been answered on Saturday, please put them wherever we're putting them. In the box, back there. So we have a kind of a lot of verses to do tonight, and the evening classes are always a little difficult because we've had a long day with a lot of stuff. So, want to try to move right ahead. So I'll forego much of a review of things that we've already done. Then maybe tomorrow we can review the whole text before moving to the, exciting conclusion. This class I've divided into two parts. The first part is the hard part, and the second part is the easy, fun part. So if you persevere through the hard part, then you get your num-nums. Dharma student num-nums at the end, where we just do fun stuff. Finding your true nature in emptiness, shunyata. Many Buddhists regard shunyata as the exclusive possession of their religion somehow. And it's very, very interesting to find this term in a text like this, as well as in a text like the Hatha Yoga Pradipika in the fourth chapter of the HYP, which is probably the second most important text in the yoga tradition, Hatha Yoga Pradipika, right after the Yoga Sutra. So shunyata is not a concept unfamiliar to many strands of the Indian-based religions. It means emptiness or voidness. It means the absence of something. And in the Buddhist tradition, they kind of run through, three or four. We'll do it four ways, okay? Three or four ways that we can regard things as being empty. Things means everything, okay? Everything in the world of form, including ourselves. So things are empty of something. Emptiness isn't something, it's the absence of something. It's the absence of something that you thought was there that isn't really there. Okay? That's what emptiness means. So one of the things that we think is there in the world around us is permanence. Permanence. We think that things are things, right? We think that things last. We think that things have endurance, some kind of permanence. Nitya. Nitya, as they say in Sanskrit. Things are empty of being permanent. They are devoid, empty, absent of having permanence to them. So, we did the thing before, right? These are a pair of glasses. Do they look like they have some endurance? Do they look like they have some stability? Some permanence, right? It looks that way, right? But this is the easiest way to understand emptiness, is the emptiness of permanence. Because our own scientists have already proved this, So you don't have to convince people of something like weirdo from the, Eastern traditions. This thing is a changing thing. And everyone recognizes that, right? If you think about it for 1 second, you realize it's a changing thing. It doesn't look like a changing thing. Right? And we don't regard it as a changing thing when we're not thinking about it. But when we think about it, of course we know it's a changing thing. And I had a student who went on the internet and found out that modern scientists somewhere have estimated the rate of change of things like this. And it's not just glasses, okay? It's, everything. It's the chair, it's the floor, it's mat, it's your bottom, everything. Is changing at the rate of 3 trillion times a second. They got some really super stopwatch or something. They go, perhaps they'll develop faster stopwatches in the future, so maybe it's not just 3 trillion times. Inconceivable. 3 trillion times a second. So in a sense, you could say there's nothing that changes. You know, it changes, changing so fast that you can't really say there's something that changes if it's changing 3 trillion times a second. Right? But it doesn't look that way, and we suffer because we forget that things are changing, that things are empty of having permanence. All the time we suffer, right? Is your job a permanent thing or an impermanent thing? Your career, your profession. And then when it changes, we go, you know, you get fired, or, you know, you bump down, or, you know, somebody replaces you, or you hate it after a while, or something like that. How could this have happened? I was so enamored of my profession, and now it's bringing me something. Well, it's changing. Are relationships changing or unchanging? What do you think? All the time changing, right? And then when they change in ways that we didn't want them to, now how could this have happened? You've changed. You know? Well, of course, you know. How could I have helped? How could I help? Everything's changing. We're all changing, right? You see? We suffer because we assume that the things that we want not to change won't change. Things that we want to change, we're happy when they change, right? But the things that we don't want to change, when you buy a new iPhone 6, is it a changing thing or an unchanging thing? It's starting to its own destruction from the time it leaves the Apple store. It's just a matter of time. Although things nowadays are moving so quickly that we don't really wait long enough for them to break before we get sick of them. We just, you know, like throw them out because they're obsolete 6 months later or 2 years later, something like that. But eventually, right, the iPhone, you know, the iPhones are, they boot up, and then one day, an iPhone or a computer or any of these gadgets, one day they won't boot up, right, because they're changing. They weren't always going to boot up from the very start. And then, you know, we go, oh my God, you know, I'm having such a bad day. My computer didn't boot up. Or my car didn't start. You know, as soon as you drive the car off the car lot, it's waiting not to start. So, you know, and then, you know, you press, you don't even have keys anymore, right? You just press buttons now. Or talk to it, maybe? I don't know. You press buttons, and then they start. You press button, they start. Press button, start. And then one day you come into your car, you press the button, it doesn't start. You go, oh, I'm having a really bad day. I'm really, a disaster because my car changed. It's a changing thing. It was never always going to start up, you see? The relationships are changing. What about your body? Is it a changing thing or an unchanging thing? Yeah. Anyone getting older here at all? Growing older? Yeah, it's changing all the time, right? And then, you know, if you are attached to the idea that your youth won't change, your vitality, your health, if you're attached to that absurd idea, then when change asserts itself with your body, then you get a freak out, right? Oh my God, look, I've got wrinkles. Well, what'd you expect? If you got lucky enough to get old enough to have wrinkles, you will get wrinkles, right? I had a yoga teacher in Los Angeles, on the west side of Los Angeles where all the fabulous people live. And she was a fabulous person, you know, and she's a very good yoga teacher and all like that, but very attached to her looks, you see, very attached to, you know, to how she looked. And she was getting older. And, you know, one day I went to yoga and she said, hi. and I said, well, hi, how are you doing? I'm fine. How do I look? She had work done. I think that's what they call it, right? You know, this is a person who couldn't stand the idea that she wasn't going to look young forever. And then she just looked like a corpse instead, you know. Kind of a zombie, you know. Have you seen it? What people like that? Yeah, kind of like aliens or something. So everything is empty of changelessness. How's that? Devoid of unchangingness. So that means you can put it positively. Everything's changing. Everything's changing all the time. And at a rate that we can't even fathom. You see? 3 trillion times a second. I mean, how can you get your mind around a number like that? 3 trillion times a second. Okay? Second sort of understanding, and this is from Buddhism, really. Things are empty of being without parts. In other words, holes are empty of being holes without being made up of parts. I know that's very convoluted, right? So maybe just use an example instead. This looks like one thing here, right? Whole. W-H-O-L-E. W-H-O-L-E. You're right? It looks like one thing, doesn't it? Don't look at her. Look at me. Look at me.
I'm trying to get to look at you more with this light.
Okay. I should have that on my t-shirt instead. Look at me. This looks like one thing, doesn't it? It looks like a singular thing. You know, we say a pair of glasses, but we mean, you know, one glasses, right? Does this thing have parts? Yeah. It has, you know, you could say it has the two bows, it has the frame in the front, it has the lenses, it has parts, right? So the whole, the glasses, are made up of the parts, right? Do the parts have parts? So are there parts to the right, what do you call this thing again? Bow. Are there parts to the right bow? Oh yeah, you know, there's this part, there's the front part, there's the middle part, and there's the back part, you could say, right? Are there parts to the front part of the bow? You know, left side, right side, top side, bottom side, right? Are there parts to the parts of the front part of the bow? And down you go until you get tired. Okay? There is no part that can't be further divisible into its parts. Okay? Even conceptually, you can't say that there is a partless part. Because a partless part would mean everything. It would mean there's no right side, there's no left side, there's no top side, there's no bottom side, there's no front side, there's no back side. That would be a partless part, you see? So things are empty of existing as wholes without being made up of parts. Okay? No partless part. Okay? Everyone all right with that? Okay. So far so good, okay? So now we'll do a little trick. And before we get to the third and fourth one. We said that things were empty of being permanent, which means that they, or you could put it like this, that things are empty of not coming from causes. See, a permanent thing also is something uncaused. It doesn't have a beginning, and because it doesn't have a beginning, it will not have an end. That's a permanent thing. So every caused thing is an impermanent thing. Okay, so far? Still? Every caused thing will last as long as the energy of the cause that brought it into existence lasts. And then it will end, right? So things are empty of not having causes. Things are empty of being causeless. Okay? Everything has a cause. So which comes first? The cause or the effect? Let's take the example, a typical example in Indian texts. The sprout comes from the seed, right? So the seed, you can say, is the cause of the sprout. Which comes first, cause or effect? It is a trick question, but come on, answer it. Everyone knows, cause, right? Cause has to come before an effect, right? The seed has to come before the sprout, right? Is the effect an effect? Is the cause a cause before there is an effect? Can you say that the seed is the cause of the sprout before there's a sprout? No. So which comes first, cause or effect? Neither one can come first. Neither one can come first. Okay? A cause is a cause because it has brought about an effect. And an effect, of course, is an effect because it's been brought about by a cause. But neither one can come first. Neither one can exist without the other. That's interdependence, okay? That's how things do exist, interdependently, not independently. If there was a cause that existed as a cause without its effect, it would be an independently existing cause. But the cause depends on its effect to be an effect, just like the effect depends on the cause to be a cause. Get it? Okay, good. Which comes first, the whole, W-H-O-L-E, or the parts of the whole? Which comes first, the glasses or the parts of the glasses? Huh? Which one? The parts, you'd say, right? You put together the parts into a whole, right? So you have to have the parts of the glasses first before you have glasses. Put together the parts of the glasses, and then you have glasses. Everyone okay with that? That's how we usually think, right? Are they parts of the glasses until there are glasses? They're not parts of a glass. They're just random things, you see? Something else. They become parts of the whole when there is a whole for them to be parts of. Right? So which comes first, the whole or the parts? Neither one can come first. Okay? Neither one can come first. There can't be a whole without parts, but there can't be parts of a whole unless there's a whole. Throwing you into the deep end here. Just, yeah. No, I mean, these are things that should, like that old song, things that make you go, See, the world can't be the way we think it is. The world can't be the way we assume it is when you start analyzing it. Right? Things are empty of existing independently. They only exist interdependently. Only. And that, so never mind glasses and sprouts and stuff. How about an irritating person? Anyone have an irritating person? People who come to the ashram sometimes think they don't have irritating people. No, they're challenging. I'm challenged by them sometimes, you know. Come on, let's be honest. We all have irritating people in our lives, right? Are there independently existing irritating people in the world? That would mean a person who was sort of by nature, essentially, like tattooed, born to irritate. Huh? Are there people like that? If you're honest, when you're thinking about your irritating person, you would say, yeah, man, they must be like that. What's the proof that they are not essentially, independently, empty of being independently irritating? What's the proof of it?
Everybody else loves them.
They have friends.
Yeah.
And that really throws us for a loop, doesn't it? Like, that, how, what? You're so irritating. How could you have friends? And then, you know, and then we go and talk to their friends. And how can you be friends with them? They're so irritating, you know. Well, I don't find them irritating. I go, what? You know, right? It's astounding to us. It's obvious that they can't be independently irritating people because they don't, not everyone finds them irritating. I've done this rap many, many times. Somebody in some class raised their hand and said what we all think before, but don't say because the filter goes on in time that prevents us from saying really stupid things. But this filter, the filter was defective and this person would raise their hand and said, I know someone that everyone would find irritating. You know, like we should all get on a bus and, you know, go on a field trip to visit the one independently, self-existently irritating person and just file by them and just get irritated. Oh, yeah. But we all think this, don't we? When we're not thinking. When we're not just doing a nice little, like, you know, exercise here at the ashram, when we're confronted with an irritating person, we think they are irritating. That's who they are. That's essentially who they are. It's independently irritating. Here's another sort of aspect, another way to prove that there are no independently irritating people in the world. Not only is it that they have friends and people that love them and stuff like that, Can there be an irritating person until and unless you are irritated by the person? You see, they depend on you to be irritated for them to be irritating. Right? You know, you can't be irritated all by yourself either, by the way. You know, sometimes it seems like people are. But really, you need some irritating thing for you to be irritated. So to be irritated, you have to have something irritating. But for it to be irritating, what? You have to be irritated. And that's, again, an example of interdependence. And neither one can come first. Again, neither one can come first. If there was an irritating person that came first, and then you were irritated by them, they would be a self-existent, independently irritating person that you just happen to run into. See, they're there being irritating. They can only be an irritating person when you join the party and get into this kind of mutual feedback loop of them being irritating and you being irritated. Right? So that's how things do exist, and they are empty of existing in any other way than that. And that's very good news, okay? It's very good news that there are no self-existent, independently existing, irritating people. Because if there were, how could you ever, like, have any other relationship with them other than being irritated? Because that's what they do. That's their whole thing. That's who they are. So there's two ways. You know, a little takeaway, okay? A little practical stuff, okay? Before we get into the, you know, the tricks here. How could you end a relationship with a person, how could you change a relationship with a person that you find irritating? There are two possibilities, okay? One of which we've tried many, many times before. Change them. Yeah. Change them so that they're not irritating anymore. And, you know, sometimes that works. Generally speaking, it does not. Generally speaking, you can't change another person. But what you can change is you. See? So, how do you disappear an irritating person? Presto changeo. Instantaneously, actually. Stop being irritated. Easier said than done, of course. But if they can only be an irritating person because you are irritated, then if you stop being irritated, they cannot be an irritating person. So you suddenly disappeared an irritating person. It's like Jesus said in the Bible, love your enemies. It's a very interesting kind of a thing, because if you get to the first word, you can't get to the third word. See? If you love them, they aren't your enemies anymore. You disappeared them as enemies. And you can disappear irritating people just like that too, because of interdependence, because things are empty. All right, so that's enough sort of clearing the throat here. Another concept that comes into play in this text, as well as in other yogic texts, especially texts like the Hatha Yoga Pradipika, is laya. L-A-Y-A. Laya. Laya is a kind of a technique for reaching emptiness, for reaching the absence of something. And it's usually translated as dissolution. Dissolution. Did I say that okay with my funny accent? Dissolution. Dissolving. Okay? So we'll see versions of this, many versions of this in the Vijnana Bhairava Tantra of reaching emptiness through dissolving. It's like I don't know, many of you are probably too young to remember, and I'm not sure that it got to Australia. The Porky Pig So I don't know if you remember the old Porky Pig cartoons. They used to end with Porky Pig. That's all, folks. And then everything would just go into blackness. A lot of techniques are like this. That's kind of laya. It's just taking everything into emptiness. Everything into the absence of anything. And these techniques, and there's Bhairava. Bhairava's there, right there. When you stop the projection, when you turn the movie off, when you stop the projection of the movie, there's Bhairava. So another way of thinking about emptiness is the condition of possibility for form, for appearances. If there weren't emptiness, there could not be appearances. They are the condition of possibility. It's like empty space. Empty space, and we'll talk about a dharana.
Hi, Sue.
We'll talk about a dharana, a technique that uses empty space. Empty space means, okay, everyone watch here a second. See where these glasses are? The location of these glasses, okay? That's empty space. We can only see empty space, we can only conceive of empty space by putting something in it and then taking it away. Because otherwise you can't see it, right? It's all around us all the time. But we can't fathom it until we have to do it kind of inferentially. You can't like directly see empty space. We have to infer that there's, you know, some location that these things sit in. And then we take it away and go, oh, that location that they used to be in. Okay. Empty space makes all things possible, right? It gives a place for all things. It's the place of all things. It's where all things sit. They sit in empty space. You see? Empty space is like emptiness. It's the absence of something that makes something possible. It's the absence of permanence that makes impermanent things possible. And everything is impermanent. So it's the absence of something that makes things like impermanent things possible. You see what I mean? All right, let's do some dharma. One should, with a mind free of conceptual thought, yeah, remember the Sesame Street word of the teachings, nirvikalpa, free of conceptual thought, meditate on the empty space in his own body in all directions simultaneously, and everything turns into empty space. So right away they're using the example of empty space. So Cindy did a very beautiful version of what is oftentimes called the empty shell meditation, where you meditate on your body as just kind of an outline and then see nothing in it, really. Clear blue sky, as she was talking about, just nothing in it. This one's slightly different. Not that different, but slightly different. I'll just describe it, you know, and then you can practice it on your own at home. I love doing this one. This one I find very, very natural. And I like to do it especially before going to sleep. By the way, there is a dharana that we're not talking about in this particular class that is very similar to what the ashram does here in Nidra Yoga. It's a dharana to concentrate on that moment right before you fall asleep. Right? It's a kind of an in-between meditation again, a madhya meditation. Between waking and sleeping, where are you? You know that kind of like that moment, that delicious kind of moment where everything's kind of like not there anymore. You know, the whole world's not there, your problems aren't there, you're not there in a way, but you're not quite asleep either. So for those of you new to the ashram, one of the big faux pas in Nidra Yoga is falling asleep, actually. And I did hear someone snoring today. So what you're supposed to do is stay at that cusp, you know, at that razor's edge between being conscious, being awake, and falling asleep. And that's another example of where Bhairava is. Right? We heard a story once about one of the swamis in this tradition who was taught by his teacher. Everything, all the spiritual teachings was taught in Nidra Yoga. Which is a...
Sachinanda.
Yeah. By Sachinanda, yeah. So that's a very interesting kind of technique to get really deep, you know? To teach people on a really deep level when they're in that kind of zone in between consciousness and non-consciousness, unconsciousness. All right, so anyway, this one, this dharana is described, you do it like this. You kind of close your eyes and you imagine... There is nothing to my right. So, you just like withdraw the projection of anything to your right, as far, infinitely. So as far as you can go on my right, there is nothing. As far as you can go on my left, there is nothing. As far as you can go on the front side, there is nothing. Back side, nothing. Top side, nothing. Bottom side, nothing. And you put yourself like kind of literally in the space of having no orientation. You see? No support. No directions. There are no directions anymore. No up, down, left, right, front or back, because there's nothing. And you're just kind of floating, free floating in empty space. So one should put one's mind with free of conceptual thought. So you can't like be sitting there thinking there is nothing, right? Because that's a concept too, in a way. So you're using the concept, there is nothing to my right, left, but then you're jumping off into the feeling. What would it feel like to be suspended in empty space with nothing in any direction, you see? Nothing to hold on to. That's a kind of move to a mind free of conceptual thought, and everything turns into empty space. Dharana 23. One who meditates non-conceptually on the emptiness of the body, even for just a moment, becomes without conceptions and comes to possess the self-nature of that which is beyond conceptual thought. So this is very similar to these other ones. You just kind of, go through. In a way, you could do it like this. You could do it. You're trying to get to the non-conceptual realization of the emptiness of the body. The emptiness of the body. So what does that mean? Is the body one thing or many things? How many bodies do you have? How many cuts does the body have? Well, which one is it? Is it one or many? Okay, so let's choose many. Although we don't think of our bodies as many, right? We project wholeness on multiple parts, right? So we have many parts. Let's just take one of them. Let's take right arm. Does the right arm have parts? Yeah, it has the hand and the forearm, let's say. Does the hand have parts? It has five fingers. Does the finger have parts? It's got the part below the knuckle, it's got this part, it's got the fingernail part. Does the fingernail part have parts? And down you go. The body is empty. See, there are no partless parts to the body. And you can use that kind of analytical understanding of emptiness until you're tired, of course. Okay, so you weren't tired enough, maybe. Does the fingernail have parts? Does it have a right side, a left side, a top side, a bottom side? Does the top side of the fingernail have parts? Does the top side of the fingernail have a right side, left side, top side, bottom side? Are there parts to the top side of the top side of the fingernail? You see where we're going with this? Do you want to do it more? You see where you go? You've got to convince yourself, though. You've got to do it long enough until you go, uncle, cry uncle. Can't be a body there. Actually, can't really be a body. Body's empty. Body's just a projection. Body's just a projection on the basis of parts that are just parts of which reposition themselves as being wholes of further parts. Body's made up of parts. This is one of the parts, which is a whole of the parts of this part, which is a whole, like a hand, which is a whole of the parts of the hand, which is finger, which is a whole of the parts of the finger, and down you go. And to think about the body that way. And this is a very good meditation for people who are attached to the body. And we're all, to some extent, attached to the body. Of realizing that the body can't really be there, actually. It's just an idea. It's a concept of the body. Yeah. Oh, doe-eyed one. He's talking to Shakti here. One should meditate on all the physical elements that constitute the body as being just empty space. There's another version of this same kind of thing, of thinking of the body as empty. And then his meditation will become unwavering. This one, by the way, Dharana 24 and 25 are often taken together. So we'll treat them that way. One should concentrate on just the skin encasing the body like a wall. There is nothing inside. Meditating on that, one becomes joined with the imponderable. This is exactly the meditation that you did, right? Cindy did. Yeah. So she really did meditation, Dharana 25 in the afternoon class. Meditating on that, one becomes joined with the imponderable. The word Sanskrit, in Sanskrit, ajaya. Ajaya means something like, you know, unthinkable. Unthinkable. And that's kind of what all these meditations are trying to get you to the unthinkable state. You know, we can think, well, there are parts to a whole, and there are parts of a parts to the whole, and there are parts of the parts of the parts of the whole, and down you go. But we're trying to get to that place, that mental space, where you can't think it. You just can't think it anymore, you see? To have the mind surrender and say, it just can't be like this. I did a meditation that some of you I've told you before. I did a retreat like this for 3 weeks once in Ireland, where five, six times a day, I would sit down as for my meditation, and I had a statue of the Buddha in front of me. And the whole retreat was like this, over and over and over again, very simple. And it was a meditation retreat on the concept of the one or the many. And I kind of did a version of this already, you know, with you. This is how I did it for 3 weeks. Is the statue of the Buddha one thing or many things? And so, you know, is the statue in front of me one thing or many things? And you close your eyes, you know, keeping the image of the statue of the Buddha in front of you. And so, well, it's one thing. There's only one statue of the Buddha in front of me. And then, and, you know, it's kind of like a tennis game or something like that. And then you go to the other side. Yeah, but there are arms, there are heads, there's legs, you know. There's parts to the statue of the Buddha. It must be many things. Well, how many statues of the Buddha are there sitting on your table? There's one statue of the Buddha, one thing. It must be one thing. But how could it have so many parts if it were one thing? It's many things. But how many Buddhas are there? It's only one thing. This is the whole meditation. 4, 5, 6 times a day for 3 weeks. One thing, many things, one thing. If it existed out there, independently, on its own, self-existently, it would have to be singular or plural. Right? Is there a third choice between singular and plural? No. So that's another part of the meditation. You've got to make a little agreement with your mind. If it were out there, like it seems to be out there, on its own, independently, externally existing. If it were out there, it would have to be singular or plural. Which one is it? And then you like sit around and play the tennis game over and over and over again. And after like 3 weeks, I got a little inkling that there's no way that the Buddha statue can be out there. There's just no way out there, on its own, independently, self-existently, you see? The only way that that objects exist is by being perceived. See? They exist when they're perceived. Okay, we'll do it like this. A perceptible object, like a statue of the Buddha, like a pair of glasses, a perceptible object is perceptible because it's perceived by a perceiver. Right? It can only be perceptible if it's perceived by a perceiver. And a perceiver can only be a perceiver if what? They're perceiving a perceptible object. And neither one can exist without the other. Perceiver can't exist without perceptible object, but perceptible object can't exist without the perceiver either. And neither one can come first. So is the Buddha statue one thing or many things? Well, it's both. Depending on how you look at it. You see? And that's kind of like the key. Things exist depending on us looking at them. Seeing them, perceiving them. And they do not exist without us. But we don't exist without them either. So sometimes you hear this kind of phrase, I am projecting my world, or something like that. Which is kind of megalomaniac, actually, you know. I'm sitting here projecting everything. I'm projecting all you guys like that. It's at best half true to say that we're projecting our world. Because the world is equally projecting us. It can't be a projector without a projection. And there can't be a projection without a projector. Neither can exist without the other. And what? Neither can come first. So interdependence. All right. First, fix your glance. This is Dharana 36. Fix your gaze on the inside of a pitcher. All right, so we have to imagine that this pitcher is empty of water, okay, because it's supposed to be empty. Fix your gaze on the inside of a pitcher or something like it, ignoring what encloses it. So this is a very interesting one because it's so easy to do. You can find pitchers pretty much anywhere, right? Glasses, pitchers, could be anything. And the whole meditation is to stare inside of it. And then ignore what encloses it. So what are you putting your mind on? The emptiness, the vacuity that the glass encloses. So you put your mind on an empty pitcher or something like that, and then you concentrate on what's inside without thinking about the glass that contains it. The mind takes on the shape of what you put in front of it. So when you're investigating the emptiness, the voidness, the absence that's inside a thing like a pitcher, what kind of shape does your mind take? Then your mind takes the shape of emptiness. It takes the shape of Bhairava consciousness. They say that a room has four walls, although this one I think has like six or eight or something. But let's say a four-walled room, okay? The room has four walls. But where's the room that has four walls? See? A room is made to be a room, not because of the walls so much, but because of the emptiness inside the walls. That's the room. Right? That's what we mean by room. It's the vacuity. It's the emptiness that's being enclosed. So here you're concentrating on what the pitcher encloses. And the pitcher encloses emptiness, empty space. Voidness like that. All right. Fix your gaze on a place without trees. I like this one a lot. Without trees or on a mountain or a wall. When the mind gets absorbed into them, the mind's activity will diminish. There's two ways of understanding this dharana. One is to go to... what they're really talking about here is a place without features. Without features. So it's like a treeless plain or something like that. The outback would work really well here, I think. Where just like kilometer after kilometer, there's nothing. Okay? Something like that. The other way to understand it actually is to say, an alternate translation is to say a place where there are no trees, where there are no mountains, or where there are no walls. So here, I've translated it or a place with mountain. But mountain here means like without trees, without kind of contours much. A place that's kind of desolate and featureless. Or a wall. Like in the Zen tradition, maybe you've heard, Bodhidharma, who brought Zen Buddhism to China, was known for his meditation technique of staring at a wall. We went to such extremes that he tied his eyelids open or something like that. Sticks or something like that. So just to stare at nothing. Yeah. So that the mind takes on that kind of featurelessness, that kind of emptiness, that kind of peace without being disturbed by the vrittis, the fluctuations of the mind. So this one's pretty good for the outback or wherever you can find it. Wherever you can find a place. I spend a lot of time in Arizona, and there are places in Arizona that are kind of like this, where you just kind of look and it's just kind of nothing. And you just kind of like... And that's kind of what you're supposed to do, the kind of mindset of it. Okay? Kind of bored into Bhairava, something like that. Sitting in the proper position, curve each arm in a half circle. Place the mind in the empty space. There should be, there's a little typo there. So it should be in the empty space. Place the mind in the empty space in the middle of the circle, and one will attain peace through this dissolution Laya. This is a Laya one. So the instruction here, there's two different ways of understanding this one, too. One commentator says that you're supposed to place your mind on your armpits, on the emptiness of the place of the armpits, which never made much sense to me. Here's the better, seems to me, better way. You put your arms like this, you sit down straight back, you put your arms like this, and you put your mind in the space that the arms are enclosing. Okay? And not looking through and looking over at the other parts of the ashram or anything like that, but just in the empty space that the arms are enclosing. Like the hole in the middle of a donut. Which actually makes the donut possible, right? Donut wouldn't be a donut without the absence in the middle. Okay? So that's cool, and you can do that. Probably not on the tram in Melbourne all that much. So you want to wait till you get home, in the privacy of your home, to do this one. But, yeah, it's okay. Meditate on the self taking the form of empty space, stretching out endlessly in all directions. Shakti in the form of consciousness, being freed of any resting place. This is a very crucial kind of understanding in this text, and one that you find, I mean, some version of it in many of the dharanas. Nir ashraya, taking out the support, taking out the resting place, taking out the thing that, you know, kind of keeps the mind held onto something, and withdraw it, pulling the rug out from underneath the mind. So the way this one is described is like, you know, to just try to not think of anything, but to think about the possibility of consciousness. So, you know, we're talking about Bhairava consciousness, or sometimes they call it pure consciousness. Sat Chit Ananda in the Hindu tradition. Sat means reality or truth. Chit means consciousness. Ananda means bliss. This is kind of another way of talking about what this text talks about, Bhairava consciousness. So what the chit here, consciousness, is not consciousness of something. Okay? We are conscious right now of being in the, you know, in the temple here at the ashram, being together, conscious of hearing my talk. You know, we're conscious, usually conscious of something. Pure consciousness is the condition of possibility for consciousness of something. Okay? It's the potential to be conscious of something, but it's not consciousness of something. See? Pure consciousness means without an object of consciousness. People don't seem to be like reverberating with that much. It's like the arena in which consciousness can happen. Right? The stadium in which the football game happens. The football game is consciousness of something. But where is that happening? What space is that happening in? So that's pure consciousness. And many of these dharanas are trying to get the mind into that kind of pure consciousness state. All right. Dharana 71. Meditate like this. There is no internal apparatus of the mind. There's no ego, there's no intellect, there's no other functions inside me. Because of the absence of concepts, vikalpa, one becomes free of conceptual thought. This is an interesting one. It's similar to, for those of you who have studied, you know, some form of advanced Buddhism, Mahamudra meditation. A Mahamudra meditation is meditating on the emptiness of the mind. So, you know, we did some kind of emptiness on the, you know, meditations on the emptiness of the body, because the body is just made up of parts that are made up of their parts, made up of their parts, etc., etc. But the mind's like that too. There is no such thing as a mind. Okay? A mind. There's a brain, okay? But when we're talking, and a brain is made up of, you know, of infinite parts, just like everything else, physical. But when we're talking about the mind, we're talking about something intangible. And the mind has functions, but there is no such thing as a mind. Okay? The mind has various functions. It has the function of remembering. It has the function of discriminating between things. It has activities. But there is no thing that has activities. See? There's no mind. Here's another way of looking at it. There's no mind that thinks until and unless there's a thought thunk. Okay? If there was really a mind, you could say there was, really means independently existing. You could say there was a mind that does not think. But the mind exists as a mind only when it thinks a thought. Okay? And of course there are no thoughts that aren't thunk by a mind. So there's no thinker without a thought. There's no thought without a thinker. Neither can exist without the other, and neither can come first. Neither can come first. So this is a, you know, meditation on the emptiness of what we call the mind and any one of its parts. Okay? There's no ego. No such thing as an ego. The ego exists in the same kind of way that everything else exists, interdependently, in relationship. So I am who I think I am in relation to others, right? They're only in relation to others. And others exist in relation to me. And neither exists before the other, and neither can come first. Then you can run it through any aspect of the mind. So this is a meditation on the emptiness of your own mind, of what we call the mind. Dharana number 90. When one stands above and looks down into something like a well or deep hole, the mind becomes free of conceptual thought, and immediately the dissolution of the mind occurs. So I don't know, it's hard to find deep wells anymore. But if you find one, or a really deep hole. Deep hole means a hole that you cannot see the bottom of. And you stick your head inside there, and you look down, and you stare into the nothingness. And you put your mind there. And again, the mind takes on the image of what you put before it. Because there is no mind apart from what you put before it, you see, independently of what you put before it. So this is the staring down the deep hole dharana. Hard to find these nowadays. Are there still wells around? Deep wells around where you could actually stick your head and look down them? Okay. So if you happen to run into one of those in Melbourne, that which is unknowable and unapprehendable, empty, and which remains outside of existence, one should conceive of Bhairava as all that, and at the end, awakening will occur. This is one, as best as I can understand it, this is one which uses concepts to go beyond conceptual thinking. So, for example, we have a concept of unknowable. We say God or ultimate reality is unknowable. So what is that concept exactly? What do we mean by a concept like unknowable? And you think about that concept. See? A concept like unknowable or infinite. We have a concept of infinity, right? But if you like analyze what it is that we mean by a concept like infinity, we get beyond the concept of infinity. See, our minds can't handle it. Our minds explode when we think long enough on things that are unknowable, unfathomable, unapprehendable, infinite and stuff like that, empty. Then one could conceive, so we're using conception, to explode conceptuality. And there's several of them like this. I think we'll hit a couple of them tonight. When one places the mind on outer space, yeah, this is one that I was thinking of, which is unchanging, without support, empty, all-pervasive, and free from limitation, one enters the realm of spacelessness. Akasha in Sanskrit. So when one places one's mind on bahya, akasha, the outside, you know, space, one enters the realm of spacelessness, akasha, where things have no space. So there's a couple of ways that you can practice this. We were going to try it, as a kind of a group practice here at the ashram, because conditions are pretty suitable usually here. There's one way to do this, where you just go out and look at the stars on a clear, crisp evening. And, many of us have gone for a long, long time without seeing the stars properly, I bet. If you're living in cities, you are definitely not seeing the stars properly. You get out into the country and, on a kind of a dark night, a moonless night, preferably. And, especially in the autumn or early spring or something like that, where the air is crisp, and you just lie down on the grass somewhere and look up at the infinity of outer space. I did some research on this recently. We did a version of this. We call it stargazing, at another retreat in America this last year, winter. And I did some research on it. The astronomers estimate, of course they can only estimate, the number of stars in the cosmos as 10 to the 34th degree. I don't know that there's a name for a number like that. Just unfathomable. Can't really get your head around. Like the universe that we live in. So you go out and you meditate on the universe that we live in, and you go, OMG. And have your mind explode. Yeah. We live in such little, tiny, little, like, bubbles, in our lives, in little, tiny, little, finite, little bubbles. But we're actually living in an incredible universe, right? That you can get some glimpse of by looking at the stars on a cloudless, clear night. And so that's a very good dharma. That's a fun one, stargazing. Alright. How can there be knowledge of or action done in relation to the unchanging true self, the Atman? External objects exist dependently on being known. The whole world is thus empty. There's two things being going on in this dharana. One is to say that the true self, our true nature, ultimate reality, is unknowable. Unknowable through what? Conceptual thought. You can't really know conceptually who you really are. So it's, again, by dropping conceptions of self, dropping limiting conceptions of self, that you get in touch in a non-conceptual way with who you truly are. So that's one thing. And then the other thing is of that part of it is to say, karma is completely, does not affect that self at all. Karma does not affect it. What you do and the consequences of that, cause and effect and all of that, have no effect on your true self at all. It is independent of karma altogether. And as many of you maybe know, the whole point in Indian-based religions, Hinduism, Buddhism, yoga, and so forth, is to get out of karma. To escape karma, not to better your karma. I mean, it's important to better your karma. It'll be better for you to have better karma. And, if you want to know how to better your karma, it's very simple. Do unto others as you'd have them do unto you. Do not do unto others as you would not have them do unto you. And live your life like that. And that will better your karma. Things will improve in your life. But that's not the goal. The goal is to get off the wheel of samsara, which is the wheel of karma altogether, to not be affected by karma. So in a text that I quoted, I think this afternoon, the Ashtavaka Gita, which is very comparable actually to this text in a lot of ways, there's a very important verse in that text, a very striking verse. It says, samsara. You all know what samsara means, the Sanskrit word. This cyclical life of suffering. Samsara is nothing other than the compulsion to do something all the time. The compulsion to act. And that's kind of an interesting way of thinking about karma. Karma in its results gives us the feeling that we have to do something all the time. have to fix things, we have to make them better, we have to correct them, we have to change them. There's something for us to do all the time. And that's a sort of a suffering. That's kind of one way of thinking about the basis of our suffering, is that we're never satisfied, never content. We always feel like we have to be doing something all the time. And the goal, ultimately, of all of these traditions, yoga, Hinduism, Buddhism, all of them, is to be free from that compulsion. To be free from the compulsion to have to do something all the time. Kartavya in Sanskrit means to be done. There's always something to be done. And to realize that contentment is the contentment with things as they are, here and now, right? Here and now. Nothing needs to be changed. Nothing needs to be different. To coin a phrase, it's like this now. Okay? And so this is a mantra that I've been spreading around the world, actually. So say Om. This is how you get a mantra, right? Transmission of a mantra. Say Om. It's like this now. Ahum, yeah, you can say Ahum. And that's the reality mantra, because it always is like this now, actually. It's never not like this now. You know what I mean? It's getting us in touch with reality, but it's also a kind of an acceptance mantra. You know, it's like this now. The mantra isn't, it's like this now, and it shouldn't be like this now. The mantra isn't, it's like this now, and I wish it weren't like this now. That's not the mantra. Because you know what? It doesn't matter whether you wished it were different or better or something else, because, you know, it's like this now. It's always like this now. And, you know, you could say that this whole text, 112 different tricks to try to get us into the present, to try to bring us into the present moment. Because our suffering comes from not being in the present, not accepting the present. Say, no, it should be different, it should be, you know, improved, or I wish it were like it used to be. You know, the older you get, the more that comes into play. Nostalgia. You know, there's so much better music in the 60s. I wish it were like that now. But you know what? It's like this now. You know. So we've been talking about two kinds of discontentment, right? The discontentment of I want something that I don't have. Or in the other kind, that's raga. And the discontentment of I don't want something that I do have. And those are two ways of rejecting the fact that it's like this now. It's like, raga means it's like this now and I wish it were not like this now. I wish it were better than this now, right? For one form of discontentment. And then dvesha, you know, the aversion means it's like this now and I don't want it to be like this now. And, you know, it doesn't really matter whether you don't want it to be like this now or you want it to be better than this now, because you know what? These are two of what they call the root kleshas, you know, raga dvesha. Root mental afflictions. The third root mental affliction is ignorance, they say. Avidya in the yoga traditions. And you can also run that, kind of avoidance or a denial of it's like this now with that one too. Ignorance, it involves the idea that it shouldn't be like this now. That's ignorant. Because you know what? It's like this now, and you're not the cosmic lord that decides what should be now. Because it's like this now. Okay? So the three main mental afflictions, ignorance, desire or craving, and aversion, are all three different ways of avoiding the fact that it's like this now. And fully accept it. Fully accept reality as it is. Okay? Which doesn't mean that, oh, it's like this now, whatever. So, I'm maybe trying to stave off some questions from the question box on Sunday. Contentment doesn't mean complacency. Okay? Acceptance doesn't mean apathy. It's like this now, so what's best to do? You see? You have to accept the situation before you can truly decide what's best to do in it. If you're trying to avoid the situation, trying to ignore it, trying to bypass it somehow or something like that, then you never really have the effective means of dealing with it. So acceptance is the precondition for understanding what your best action is in relation to the fact that it's like this now. See? It's like getting a hand of cards, you know, when you're playing a card game. We saw somebody playing some card games earlier today. I guess they're not here tonight. Oh, yeah, there they are. So, you know, when you get a hand of cards, you know, you pick up your hand and it's like this now, the hand of cards, right? And you don't say, oh, I wish I had different cards, or I don't like these cards, because these are the cards that you've been dealt. It's like this now. And, you know, you can run that metaphor through every situation in life. Every moment in life, we're getting a hand of cards. And in the card game of life, you can't just say, no, I'll give me a new hand. Or you can't, like in some card games where you can say, I don't want these two cards, but I'll keep these three. And you know, the cosmic dealer doesn't give you, like, you know, two new ones back. You get, these are the cards that you have. So the next question is, how best to play them? But you first have to accept the hand before you can move to the next step of how can I most skillfully play the cards that I've been dealt. So that's acceptance of reality, right? That's acceptance of reality and acceptance of the possibility of action, of proper action in reality. All right. Oh, so the other part of it is external objects exist dependently on being known. There's no knower without a known, and there's no known without a knower. Neither can exist without the other, and neither can exist first. That's kind of what that means. All right, part two. Now the fun stuff. Finding your true nature through sound. This is there's a kind of a yoga. I don't know if you studied it. Nada yoga, the yoga of sound. And this is full on nada yoga. O Bhai Ravi, one who recites Om and other such seed mantras and then meditates on emptiness at the end of the drawn out version of such recitation, arrives at emptiness, through the highest Shakti. So this dharana is simply to do this, to recite the sacred syllable Om in its long version. That means that you kind of draw it out, you elongate it. And then you put your mind on the silence when the mantra ends. And where are you then, you see? Who are you then? What are you then? Through emptiness. Arrives at emptiness through emptiness. So silence is a form of emptiness. So you arrive at the mental understanding of emptiness through use of silence, which is another kind of emptiness. All right, so we've chanted Om enough maybe today. Let's do it another way. We'll listen to a bell. Okay, so the whole mantra here, the whole meditation actually, is to just listen to the sound of the bell and follow the sound into silence. And hold your mind on the silence. It's a pretty good place to do it because it's pretty silent here. All right, ready? Let's see if I can do this right. So where does the sound go exactly? You could also say, where does it come from? You know, where is the sound before the sound starts? And where does the sound go when the sound ends? Should I do it again? I like this one. So you can do that either with an om or with a bell at home. Even one who contemplates on what is before and after the sound, that person becomes joined with emptiness through emptiness. He assumes the form of emptiness. So that was like the meditation on where the sound goes and what happens right before the sound. Yeah, like that. Same kind of meditation, basically. One commentator says, you hold that energy of just about to recite a mantra like Om. The energy of just beginning. Haven't started it, but just beginning. Hold that energy of just beginning or just ending. Kind of interesting way of talking about it. One who with single-mindedness stays fixed for a long time on the sound of music made by a lute or other stringed instruments will, at the end of the process, become embodied in the space of the Supreme One. Please skip down to next page, because there's another one very similar to this, Dharana 50, on page, whatever that is, 14. Through the unequaled joy of being absorbed completely in the sound of beautiful music and such, the yogi's mind is elevated and becomes one with that, one with ultimate reality. These are two versions of using music to lose yourself. And Cindy did a kind of a version of it in the afternoon class. Technically, you're supposed to use music that has no words. There was words to this music that she played. Did you notice? They were Sanskrit words. We were trying to figure it out. The Gayatri Mantra, maybe, or something like that.
Adding the other dharanas that talk about using syllables.
Okay, so okay. So if you wanted to do this at home, this is we kind of do this one naturally. There's a magic to music, you know? Music transports us into a different headspace. So we're naturally, many of us are naturally inclined to this. But the proper way, according to the instructions on doing this kind of dharana, is to find a piece of instrumental music that you really are attracted to, that you really love. So, you know, a ballad of some sort, or a piece of classical music, you know, if you're attracted to classical music. And just sit down on the couch in your lounge room, turn up the volume, put on some headphones, and lose yourself in the music. And the instructions also are not to listen to the particular notes, but to try to lose yourself into the whole melody. See, when we're concentrating on particular notes, we're using that conceptual mind, dividing things up and stuff like that. So you lose yourself in the melody as a whole. Dharana 18 and Dharana 50, as far as I can understand it, are differentiated only in the fact that Dharana 50 emphasizes the joy. Dharana 18 emphasizes the music. Emphasizes kind of losing yourself in the actual music. Dharana 50 is losing yourself in the joy that the music brings you. In the beautiful feeling that the music evokes in you, like that. There's another one that I haven't included here, but we'll actually do. Live and in person. This one is Dharana, if you wanted to look at it in another text someday, 15. And I'll just read you the instruction and then we'll do it. When one steeped in knowledge of the sound of Brahman, the sound of God, listens with a trained ear to the unstruck, uninterrupted sound of a rushing river, he reaches the highest Brahman, the highest God. So this is to concentrate on a sound that, like a river. I don't know if you ever listened to a river where the sound is monotonous, just over and over again, the same sound, and lose yourself in it like that. So we couldn't really find rushing river sounds, but we found something similar. So I think she got a minute or two here? Okay, so... Just try to absorb yourself into this sound. Pretty easy to absorb yourself in that sound. No sound. Get the idea, right? Yeah. We actually live close enough and in a quiet enough place to hear the river at night. And it's there's something obviously very soothing about listening to a river or even that ocean sound or waterfall. Like, I think they make sound effect machines like this, don't they? You just can listen to waterfall and stuff like that. And why is that soothing to us? You know, what is it about that sound, that kind of sound that brings us some kind of peace? And you know, maybe one way of thinking about it is that it's because the sound is undifferentiated. It's the same sound over and over and over again. It's not varied. It's not particular. It's not individualized. It's not discrete or different, right? It's this kind of like flat, monotonous sound that brings us into that kind of headspace of calmness. All right. Do we have the slide for VAM? Yeah, that's all right. The next one is to... yeah, you can draw one. This one's one that, you know, you can use any letter with, but we'll just use one of the letters of the Sanskrit alphabet for it. This is Dharana 19. And this is like using the actual shape of a letter. Can everyone see that okay? The actual shape of a letter in the Sanskrit alphabet as a kind of a prop to do what they call a dissolution practice. I'll just describe it. It kind of depends on you being familiar with this particular letter. This is the Sanskrit semi-vowel va with nasalization. So it's vam, vam. And it was a bija mantra. It's one of the seed mantras that Cindy went through in the chakra thing. That's the mantra of the Svadhisthana chakra. Yep. The one right below the navel. And this meditation really is to imagine that you are that letter. So that's kind of why you have to be familiar with it. We thought maybe we could try it with the letter A or something like that in the Roman alphabet, the English alphabet, but, you know, I don't know if it would work the same. And what you do is you imagine that you fully embody that letter as being you. And then can you do the dissolution? And then you dissolve it piece by piece. So you start at the bottom, and like, you know, like a fuse on a firecracker? You ever seen like, just, ooh, I've lost my bottom. Ooh, I've lost my round part. Ooh, I've lost that too. Little by little. And then, you know, just step by step like that. Step by step, you you dissolve yourself. And then as you dissolve the very, very top bit of yourself, you hold your mind there. You hold your mind in the nothingness, in the blackness, in the nothingness. Thanks. The last three are kind of technical when it comes to... a little bit technical. Especially 67 and 68. 58, keeping the tongue inside and inverted. Put your consciousness in the middle of the wide open mouth. Mentally make the sound ha. Mentally make the sound ha. Then one will be absorbed in peace. So the idea here is to, there's two different instructions on it. One is to open the mouth and mentally imagine that you are saying ha. So there's a kind of a, right? There's a kind of a stop. There's kind of an inability to do something. An absence of something. Okay? The other one is to just do it with your mouth shut. In the instructions on keeping the mouth open, they often refer to what's called Chiquita Mudra. Mudra means
gesture,
yeah, something like that. Chiquita means one of astonishment. So there is a practice where you try to remain mindful in situations where you're completely taken aback. So, for example, I mean, if you walked on your way back to the your cabin wherever you're staying. And in the night, and all of a sudden, a kangaroo jumped right in front of you. That's Chiquita Mudra right there. You know, a sudden break in ordinary reality. A sudden break, a sudden stop of the, you know, the blah, blah, blah train of thing. What? Like that. You're seeing a bear in the woods. Like that. So, you know, obviously requires, you know, that you've been practicing a lot and thinking about this kind of stuff and all like that. But it's in those situations where our mind stops, the conceptual mind stops, and we are brought into a state of wonderment. Right? That's kind of also like what you would look like if you saw something amazing. You know, like, there's an Australian version of the Northern Lights. Aurora Borealis. Is it Australia? Is Borealis or something? The Southern Lights. No, you see them a lot in Tasmania, apparently. And it's just like the sky lights up into like a light show. I've never seen them myself. I've been in northern climates where they're supposed to be invisible. I've never seen one. I grew up in Minnesota. I should have gotten at least a view of the Northern Lights, you know, all those years freezing my ass off in Minnesota. But I never saw them. But, you know, if you did, has anyone ever seen them here? Yeah. I mean, if you saw something like that, it would just, right? Just completely awestruck. Completely dumbstruck and awestruck. And the conceptual mind just stopped. And there's my river consciousness. There you are. We went to a Dzogchen retreat. You know, Dzogchen is a form of advanced form of Buddhism. And we got an initiation. We got an initiation into our true nature. And the whole, you know, so the idea is that the Lama, the Guru, introduces you to your true self. Introduces you to your Bhairava consciousness, to your God consciousness. And the whole initiation was just, you know, pet! That was it. See, what happened to you? Where were you? Yeah, so now you just got that initiation into your true nature. The next two, the last two, we're running out of time. The last two are interesting. You kind of have to know something about Sanskrit grammar to understand these, but I'll do my best to explain. Repeat the letter A without nasalization or aspiration at the end. O goddess, and then suddenly a great flood of wisdom, the Supreme Lord will arise. In order to pronounce a Sanskrit vowel, you have to have either nasalization or what they call aspiration at the end. It's impossible to pronounce unless you pronounce it or . You can't just say. So I think the nearest equivalent in English, for example, is trying to pronounce a consonant without a vowel after it. Like the consonant K. Say K without the A part. Okay? There's Bhairava. There's Bhairava consonant. You know, it's like the mind's frustrated. The conceptual mind's frustrated. What do you mean pronounce K without the A? Is it right? Frustrating the mind. Tricking it into like non-conceptualization. And the last one's the same sort of thing. Put your mind on the aspiration at the end of a letter with aspiration, because the mind has no support, because it can't do it, can't even think it. You can't think, how could I pronounce K without the A? You can't even think it. Impossible, right? It's an impossible thing. It's like trying to think of a... I guess it's not like a horned rabbit, because you can think of a horned rabbit. But a sky flower, you know, a flower growing in the middle of empty space or something. You know, we can think these fantasy things, but you can't even think how to do it, to pronounce K without A. And then the mind stops. Then the mind shuts down. Tries and tries. It's like a koan. Like the koan, trying to solve an unsolvable riddle. And many of these techniques are trying to trick the mind into just collapsing. The conceptual mind into just collapsing and finding out what's left. So, anyway, you know, you learned a really cool mudra, Chikita mudra. And, you know, maybe you can practice it at the ashram. When you see somebody, just